Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. An outbreak of Ebola in Africa has health officials worried. Since February, almost 900 people have died in four West African countries. Two medical workers infected with Ebola have been brought to the United States for treatment amid concerns, warranted or not, that the Ebola could break out in the U.S. To learn more about Ebola and what risks, if any, people in Michigan should concern themselves with, we welcome Dr. Eden Wells, a clinical associate professor of epidemiology and director of the Preventative Medicine Residency at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me.
Let's start with a basic question of what Ebola is and where it comes from. We know it's highly contagious. Tell us more.
Yes. You know, the Ebola virus actually became known to us, as humans anyway, in the 1970s when outbreaks were occurring in the eastern and central part of Africa. And over the last few decades, this particular virus has caused very small outbreaks that tend to end quite quickly. It is a very aggressive and infectious virus. We think now that this is a virus probably that resides in bats. This is not known for sure, but we're highly suspecting that bats play a very important role in the carriage of this virus and the transmission among animals in Africa. And then at some point, should a human be exposed to an infected bat or other animal, such as a primate, such as an ape or a monkey, then that particular human can quickly spread the virus to others if those others are in direct contact with the patient when they become ill. And I remember this distinctly in the 70s as a young teen hearing about this, because the illness is quite impressive. People may start out feeling rather feverish, not well, but quickly escalate, become very ill in terms of headaches, vomiting, diarrhea, and then many of their organs fail. And a lot of it's associated with bleeding. The whole body's bleeding system gets disrupted. So it's one of the viruses that we call as a viral hemorrhagic fever, because very often, especially near death, there's a lot of bleeding involved. And so you can imagine this is something very impressive for any of us that have ever heard about that.
And for the record, how is it transmitted?
In the direct contact, so in the human population, you really have to be in close contact to the fluids of the infected person. The person may be someone you love who's becoming ill, and any kind of contact with their secretions, such as their blood, their vomit, their stool, if they're having diarrhea, if they're coughing up any infected material, any of that is highly contagious. And so you can see, actually, that many of the people in the healthcare setting are having to cover themselves up absolutely, totally, because even their eyes wear a full, what we call full barrier suit. They look like, you know, spacemen, but that's to avoid getting in contact with these fluids. But that's really the main way of transmission. So often what's happening, especially in Africa, is this: when people are caring for their loved ones who are sick, get in contact, or when they're preparing, if their loved ones or a patient passes away, they're in contact with even the dead body, which still has the secretions on it, they can be exposed in that way as well.
Dr. Eden Wells is our guest here on Current State. Dr. Wells is a clinical associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. We're talking about the Ebola situation in Africa. There's a lot of medicine and science involved when seeking to contain a disease epidemic. But when something like this happens in another part of the world, there are also strong cultural components to achieving containment. How important mm-hmm. is it to understand the culture of the people who are facing an epidemic like this?
Oh, I think what you have just raised is incredibly important and something that we're really dealing with right now. You know, when this arose in late February and March of this year, this Ebola outbreak occurred in Guinea, and Guinea had never ever, this was in Western Africa, had never experienced the Ebola virus that they knew of anyway, and as an outbreak. And this is something that is obviously very scary to people. There are traditional and cultural practices around how folks will care for their loved ones or how they care for them for funeral rites. And so many of the common practices may inadvertently cause the other citizens to become in contact with this and then spread the disease. Further, this spread quickly from Guinea to Sierra Leone and Liberia because there's a lot of travel between these countries. People get on the motorbikes and bicycles and travel across these borders, at least up until this last week or so, fairly easily. And so when they were becoming sick, maybe they were visiting in another country, they would want to go home. That's what we all want to do. But as they do that, they were going home and spreading the disease and then amongst their families in these different areas. So it's cultural, but it's also social. Really needing to understand not only the practices of what the society may do in Africa when they're ill, but also understand that when we become sick, you know, when we have a loved one become sick, we naturally, socially as humans, want to care for them and touch them. So this has been a real tough battle to try to educate people that that's precisely what we can't be doing with these sick patients. We can't touch them directly. We cannot be in contact with them at all without protection.
A fair amount of the TV coverage has centered on how one plane ride could lead to Ebola arriving in the U.S. That has scared a lot of people. Was this a responsible way, do you feel, for the media to approach this outbreak?
That's another good question. I think, you know, there is a very important role that the media plays in alerting all of us to potential dangers. And I think that is a very good thing. I think that we do need to also understand that, though, and you mentioned this in the previous question, that we have a very different healthcare and public health system here in the United States as compared to what has been occurring in the Western African countries, who have, by the way, been definitely working very hard to control this since CDC and World Health really started working with them last week. Yes, I think disease knows no boundaries, and we have seen the case of a gentleman who flew to Nigeria and then became ill and then passed away, and we are having even cases related to who had been exposed to him. But I think even in Nigeria, they have the knowledge of trying to, you know, contact people, isolate them, and then try to ensure that the disease doesn't spread. And so we're not seeing a large outbreak there. Here in the United States, there is we are even hearing on the news about people who are being tested as they come off planes because they've become ill, or they've arrived in a city and maybe become ill a day or so later. We have a high index of suspicion. We know to look for this. Our local, our state, our federal public health departments, and our hospitals have all received a lot of information, especially in the last week, from Centers for Disease Control and World Health about how to be sure to identify someone who may be at risk, quickly isolate them, meaning not letting anybody go near them, touch them, and then also to even put some people who may be suspected to have been exposed, make sure we kind of put them in a safe place too and make sure that they don't become ill. All of these things we can do here much more efficiently in the United States. I can't say that there won't be a case that shows up here, but there will not be. There's an exceedingly low risk of any type of the outbreaks that we're seeing in Western Africa, where that our kind of public health system doesn't exist.
There are, of course, the two American patients, Nancy Wright-Bohl and Dr. Kent Brantley, who are being treated with a serum known as ZMapp. What do you make of their circumstances, and what do you make of ZMapp?
You know, it's very fascinating. Now, I don't know much about ZMapp than maybe what we've all have been hearing once the company began discussing this over the weekend about the serum, this antibody, which is essentially made in reaction to Ebola infection in mice. And now they're even talking about how tobacco plants can be used for this. Very fascinating. I think there's a lot to be learned. I don't know. This was administered to both these patients. In fact, one received two doses. And it may be involved with them actually having improved symptoms and perhaps helping fight the disease. But there's a lot of information, and I think what's very good about them coming to Emory University and being hospitalized there right next door to the Centers for Disease Control is we're going to be able to learn a lot about how this serum may have worked to benefit their illness. We can also learn a lot about how the virus is affecting these two patients, who hopefully sound like they're doing better than certainly they were in the last week or two. But I don't know much yet. There's a lot more information that needs to come.
Dr. Brantley's case is particularly interesting because besides the experimental doses of ZMapp that he got, he also received a unit of blood from a 14-year-old boy who was an Ebola survivor who had been under his care, and I'm reading that may have that was apparently aimed at giving Brantley antibodies that the boy have made to the virus.
Exactly. So again, that raises the question: is how much of a role did perhaps this unit of blood from a young boy who had survived, and therefore maybe his immune system had generated these strong proteins against the virus that can actually fight the virus. You administer those into Dr. Brantley. How much even did that improve his well-being in comparison to later when he received the serum? And I think it's still unclear to me the timeline of, you know, when he received each of those products and how each of those may or may not have contributed to his subsequent improvement in course. But I think we're going to hear a lot about that in the next few weeks from our Centers for Disease Control and Emory University. As they learn, hopefully we'll get some more information how each of those helped.
Dr. Eden Wells of the University of Michigan School of Public Health, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Mark.